listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kurula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake Up Hollywood, this is your host for the most, Nikki Kurula. We're going to jump right into this interview. We have an awesome returning guest, Mr. Neil Upadhyay. Did I say it right?
Upadhyay. Come on, Upadhyay. Man. Upadhyay. I've had my name pronounced like 10 ways to Sunday. It's all good.
Well, did I say it? Did I come close? I should have been close, right?
Upadhyay.
Man, you know, I'm Nikki Kurula. Being in the arts is almost like not as favored as being a doctor or an engineer. So tell us what that transition was like for you wanting to be an artist and, you know, telling your family, this is what I want to do, and how that transition to becoming the artist that you are and working on all kinds of great things like this recent Star Wars fan movie that we're excited to show. And just, you know, give us a little bit of background, kind of information.
My whole family's from Maharashtra, though. And then I came over to the States for the first time when I was 5 and a half. And I actually do have a lot of artistic people in my family. You know, my dad's an amazing Indian classical singer. My mom's a really amazing painter. But those aren't their careers, right? They've always dabbled out in the side. And so I got a love and appreciation of the arts from them. And I was doing that kind of, you know, in the school plays and choir and marching band, all those types of things throughout high school. Like a lot of young men, I got really into video games when I was little, and my dad.
You have like, a favorite?
Back then, yeah, probably like Metal Gear Solid.
Dude,
super nice. Into that. And my dad basically had the tack that if you're gonna play video games, you better learn how to make them. And, you know, got me into computer science and programming really early on. And I thought that was going to be my path until a little movie called Lord of the Rings came out in high school. And the behind the scenes of those three films was basically like my first film school. It completely opened my eyes to the craft and the lives of the people making the film looked even more fantastic than the fantasy world they were portraying. And it completely changed my path. And instead of looking at computer science and engineering and programming schools, I started looking at film. And I think that, you know, they were nervous, but I definitely had prepped them for being an artist, right? Because I told them I wanted to be an actor. And so then when I wanted to be behind the camera, it was such a relief. But no, look, amazing day, obviously, to get an acceptance letter from USC Film. That was really validating. My family saw that as a voter.
And you know, like, what did you do, like, student films in high school? Like, how did you kind of submit to, you know, show the interest?
Yeah, I did do one student film in high school. But the program to USC really just goes off of writing samples because they want to kind of even the board. Not everyone will have access to cameras. And that was well before smartphones. So it was a lot harder to have access to the equipment you need. So rather than take a film submission, they did everything off of writing samples. And so it was really
writing screenplays then.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. It wasn't even a screenplay. It was just a short story.
Wow. And then, so you get into this grade school and then you show up day one. And I know you probably were bright eyed and bushy tailed like I was when I went to music school, and yes, our schools are right next door to each other.
Yeah, they were.
Like, you get this like amazing badass. And then you slowly realize, oh my God, everybody's a badass. I got to make sure that I can just hang and just do the work and survive college and just be as focused. Tell me what that was like for you.
Well, it was incredible to have that first semester where all I did was take film classes. I knocked out a bunch of GEs beforehand at a community college that I was a spring admit. And okay, so that gave me like one semester to just go and knock out a bunch of GEs at a community college, knowing I was already admitted in the spring. And so that first semester, just getting to focus on a craft that I love, that I wanted to work in, was incredible. And I think that's the biggest thing I've gotten out of USC, is just being around like-minded people who want to be in that energy and want to collaborate. And, you know, not one person ever asked to see me. I worked with people from that cohort at USC innumerable times, right? I've worked with my 310 partner innumerable times since then. And so that's the biggest thing that USC really gave me.
And did you find that, like, you had like similar visions of people that in the film school? There were, I'm sure there were tons of people that my bulldog Otis wanted to say hello. Hey, did you find like there was like a similar vision as to like doing the work or working? There's a camaraderie because you're all in film school together. Or did you find like there were differences in views or, you know, competitiveness that kind of maybe turned you off from working with people? How did you kind of find your crew and kind of make those kind of those moves?
I think I found my crew pretty quickly, honestly. Some of the people that my roommate ended up actually being a guy that I met back in Iowa when I was in middle school, and, wow, and we've done little movies and projects together way back then. And he was actually in the music school with you, Nikhil. He was in the composing for film.
Oh, TV, very cool.
Program, which I think was like a 4-year classical and then 1-year master's. It was like a 5-year program. Yeah. So he was in that. He did the music for all of my films when I was at USC, and he was my roommate too. And we worked at the U Club together as waiters. So, yeah, we did everything.
Not fight with each other, or like, you know.
Oh, it was incredibly unhealthy and you know, codependent relationship. But you don't know that then. You only know that after you grow up. And
you're like, maybe we shouldn't have spent all our wake hours together.
With him, and we collaborate to this day. And yeah, his name's Jay Vincent. He's awesome. He's actually the composer on Lego Ninjago, just a kids show that's on its, I don't know, 12th season now. It's wild. So yeah, he writes music for Lego Ninjas, and the kids love it. The internet is to be believed. The kids quite love it.
And tell me a little bit about this experience that you got at USC. Just, you know, what a lot of people don't know is USC's film school is one of the best in the country, but it also can compete with a lot of the film houses of today in the market. Like, the school looks like a film studio, like Paramount or Fox or any of those. So tell me what that experience was like, just getting that hands-on experience using the equipment, and et cetera.
Well, we're talking about the OG film school, right? It doesn't look like it does now.
That's true.
I tried to go to where it took some, like, it's right. bike racks where right. our building was, right next to that super sweet facility. But the experience there and having the access to that equipment was great, especially because I was in the last class that actually shot on film.
Wow.
They switched to digital right after us. And so, getting experience with digital was, you had no choice, right? Like after that, the whole industry swung, but getting to have this now very rare experience of actually shooting on film stock, the discipline it takes to really, you know, basically shoot with a light meter, have a deeper appreciation for how films were made for the 80, 90 years before that point really grounded me and I think strengthened my skills. So it was really awesome to be right on the tail end of a program that was about to do this huge switch.
What was the biggest difference that you found just shooting on film and then shooting on digital? I know a lot of the lighting, but also the time, you know, that you're allowed to shoot on digital versus film, there are kind of like minimalistic confines that you have. So tell me a little bit about that transition.
You have a ticking clock. It literally is running through your camera. You know that you've only got 400 feet, 600 feet. And so you don't roll on nothing, you know. I suppose if you're a big film production with endless stock, you can, but you have to be a lot more judicious about when you roll the camera. And so while a film set is always going to have the pressures of the day and light conditions, sun falling, the extra pressure of having a finite amount of footage to shoot, it definitely ratchets up the tension a little bit and just makes you really judicious and it forces you to know what you want. And it's, you couple that with delayed gratification, not being able to see what you shot.
Right.
Not 100% knowing you got it. You might think you got it. And then there might be a, you know, a hair in the gate and all of a sudden your shot's ruined or there was a light leak or something. That also just, it's a leap of faith. You know, right. You're saying we got it. And everyone's tearing down that shot and moving on. And you don't really know if you got it.
Wow.
And so it's just really different. You know, it's not this what you see is what you get filmmaking, where you're just looking at the viewfinder. And
does it give you more for, you know what I mean? Because you know, they had, and then you see it, and it's like, man, these are like masterpieces that are just on film. You know, it's like, it's so crazy. A friend of mine took me on a tour of the Fox lot that when he worked there, and I got to see the actual original film reels of the original Star Wars. And I was like, this is like biblical. You know what I mean? This is insane. But you know, when you read about all the stories that it took to make something like that, I'm sure your appreciation of the art form on that medium skyrocketed just going through that. Now tell me, you make this transition to digital. Is it more of a relief because you can see things in the viewfinder or that you know that you're not confined by the time restraints in the same way? You can kind of get an idea of what you're looking at if you actually do have the shot. How does that change your process?
Well, it does change your process in that you know when you got it a lot more confidently, and knowing you don't have it then can potentially make you spend too much time on the shot and you go in for take after take after take. And so it becomes actually dangerous in another way, you know, because confines usually increase creativity, right?
Right.
And so the fact that now some of these shackles are getting taken off forces you to discipline yourself.
It allows you to, it can make you more indulgent because you can take your time on shots or do more. So you find you're like pushing the timetable.
Well, yeah. Well, it's not even just on set, right? This axiom of fix it in post really, really came to popularity, I think, especially in the digital solution. viewfinder. It's what you're going to do in post to fix it.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's but I don't really think there's any going back. You'll still always have people who shoot on film, just like you'll always have people who want to read physical books, you know, instead of an audiobook or a Kindle or something. It's just a different medium, and it has its own look and it has its own properties. I don't think it's better, but it's just a different challenge, you know, like right. It's not like doing visual effects well is easier because the bar has changed. There's more accessibility to tools but the bar has just changed. And more people can do it. So the competition is a lot higher now. And it really comes down to story and character being the great equalizer. And people aren't going to because it's more accessible.
Right. It comes down to the emotions and the story and the arc of the characters, all those good things. Now, you know, one thing I really respect about film, and, you know, I'm working on this animated project, and I've seen like how dialed in everything has to be, down to the shots, the shot lists, locations, all of that.
You did an animated project, you said?
Yeah, I'll have to show it to you, man. We'll have to collaborate on this.
Awesome.
But, you know, it's like you realize like how dialed in film has to be, because there's already going to be obstacles in every step along the way, and you find that the more organized you can be about the locations, the shots, et cetera, the easier on some level it's going to be. You finish school and now you're doing it in the real world. Did USC prepare you in a way, or did you feel like when you got out of school, you learned enough, but it was like going through a whole nother school of hard knocks, figuring it out in the industry? Tell me what that was like for you.
Well, I actually ended up in the video game industry out of school after studying film. So wanted to be in video games, changed to film, went to film school, got into video games. So yeah, the first job I actually got out of college was at Electronic Arts, and I'm still here 14 years later. And so
it's one of the biggest ones. They're one of the biggest ones.
Yeah, definitely. And you know, at the time I had the choice to join a post house and dub tapes in the back and, you know, be on a track to become a union editor. One day I'd get to touch an Avid. And the other option was to go into video games and start cutting right away. But on like video, on podcasts and marketing trailers and things like that. But I decided to go that route because I knew that by cutting every day, I was going to get better at my craft every day.
Right.
And I definitely feel like, you know, the Lord's rewarded that patience. And there's been a lot of times when I was like, I'm in the wrong place. You know, my friends that were getting coffee for Seth MacFarlane are now, you know, in the writer's rooms, and I've gone into the wrong industry. But I've just seen over the last 14 years, our industries merge. You know, film games have become more cinematic and respected. Right. For the types of stories that they're able to author. They're their own medium. They can do things that films just can't do, which I find fascinating. You know,
You've gone to E3, I'm sure, all the time.
Oh, yeah, many times, yeah.
So I played it one time, and I didn't even know that there was this huge video game conference, and it's this whole, like,
it doesn't happen anymore.
Right, right.
And then I killed that thing dead.
Right, right. But it was amazing when it was happening. I was like, yeah. This is insane. So, you know, it starts to filter into itself, you know. Did you find that video games changed the way you looked at film, or film made you change the way you looked at video games?
That's a good question. I don't know if video games made me change the way I looked at film, but film definitely impacts how I look at games. You know, the big difference with games is that the hero is the player. You might have a character you're controlling on screen, and the designer's job is to try and make you associate with the experiences of that character on screen as much as possible, to create just reduce the friction to you immersing yourself into that little avatar. But that avatar is not the hero, because you're making every choice for that avatar, right? The protagonist needs to make choices. That thing can't do it. So the player is actually the hero. So the ultimate story of the game is the player doing things that the player thought was meaningful, the player overcoming obstacles that to some level to them were real, the player experiencing emotions, and sometimes things happening to them, like the game's plot does something and it elicits a reaction, and the player experiencing that reaction, that's the story that they're telling through playing your game, you know? So, and that applies to whether it's Tetris and right. It's getting harder and harder and harder and harder, or a story based single player game like Metal Gear, or something that's completely multiplayer, you know, like Apex Legends or Fortnite. And so that's the real challenge with interactive is how do you champion the player story? But that opened the opportunity to point to is the opening level of like the first user experience really in Battlefield 1. And it's a game about World War 1, and it drops you into the to like the Battle of the Bulge, and you run out as a soldier and almost immediately you get shot. And then it puts up the character's name and their birthday and the day they died. And then immediately you spawn as another character and you run out and you immediately get shot. And it keeps on kind of throwing you into the meat grinder with no expectation of survival. And because of the trope of games of, oh, okay, I'm going to respawn, I'm going to come in, you understand the mechanic, but putting up someone's name and their birthday and the day of their death, and you slowly realize in the game doesn't expect you to succeed and there is no way to succeed. All of a sudden, this idea of the futility of that battle and what the actual heroes that fought on that and the lives that were sacrificed in that meat grinder, all of a sudden it's able to make a very poignant message come across in a way that if you're just passively watching it, you won't get.
Right.
And so, you know, huge hats off to DICE and the developers that worked on that level. I just always look at that as a great example of how interactive is its own medium. And that's an incredibly cinematic experience, but it's the player's journey that's what you remember and what you take away.
Now, when you're working on, you know, video games and trying to make it more cinematic, it's easy to just kind of like get tired of the project or kind of find it doesn't exceed, you know, the mind experience it. How do you find yourself to like stay engaged and make that player's experience one of a kind and just like this monumental elevated experience when you're working on this day to day? And, you know, like working in graphics and, you know, that side of things, it is a slow process. That's one thing that people do not really understand is how long it takes to do all those things to connect the characters in these environments and all of that. So tell us a little bit about how you stay inspired while you're working on this.
I stay inspired by the energy I get from the people I work with. I stay inspired by just, you know, keeping your eye on the prize. It's a privilege to be able to tell stories on such a big canvas. So you don't want to take that for granted or snub your nose at it. Animation and video games and film, they're all mediums that take a long time. And you have to have like a marathon point of view on those things and use that time to make it better, right? So along the way, you're going to have little firsts and you just have to hang your hat on those. You know, the first time you actually get a rough cut, the first time you get to, you know, show it to someone else in the office, or you like, you know, kind of show it to your wife at home or something. And those reactions along the way, like validate, okay, I'm on the right path, you know? And the feedback that you get and the moments of frustration that you get, you just have to take those as prods to make it even better. And ultimately it'll never be finished. It's just a point where you have to stop.
You put it finished, you're like, I should have, blah, blah, blah. That's every artist.
It's everything, right? Yeah, you know it well. And so, yeah, I've done a number of shorts now for EA over the past 3 years. I think I've done like 8 or 9, and they all take about 8 or 9 months. And so multiple projects that kind of overlap each other at any given time. And so that's a long haul. And it's very gratifying when things come out like today. We got to launch Star Wars The Old Republic's 10th anniversary expansion pack, and it debuted with this amazing cinematic short that we got to do with Industrial Light and Magic. And so, I directed a team with ILM, tons of amazing people on the BioWare side that trusted us with their characters, and a really robust team at EA that supported it, that produced it. It's an army that makes these things, and me and my writers and all the talented artists at ILM just got to chip away at this thing, and really happy with how it came out.
Yeah, let's talk about this, because it's such an interesting project, and you know, I'm sure you're like me, we're influenced by Star Wars a great deal. I'm even wearing a Star Wars shirt. You're influenced as an artist by these great films and this whole world, and now you're working on stuff that's affiliated with it, or it's in the universe, and that's got to be, you must feel like a kid on some level, even though there's like a lot of adult work that you have to do to put into it, but it's got to take you back to those first moments of, you know, seeing those movies and being a part of that experience. Tell us a little bit of what this project was like to work on, because I'm sure you were just like a kid in a candy shop.
Oh, it's a dream, you know. I was always a huge Star Wars fan, and my appreciation of Star Wars has just grown. I've been working on the video game side of the brand for, I forget, 6-8 years now, working on, you know, trailers and marketing TV spots and things like that. And then a couple of years ago, when I started this new division at EA, working more on narrative and pulling more of our game stories into our marketing, and these series of short films started getting greenlit, and started producing them. The opportunity came up to do one for Star Wars, and that ended up being my first short film, called Hunted, and it was for a game called Star Wars Squadrons. And we got to do that with ILM, which was absolutely incredible. Working with John Knoll, who like invented Photoshop, he did the visual effects on the first Star Wars. You know, he came up with the idea for Rogue One. He's an absolute legend, and I'm getting to learn from him and his wealth of knowledge. That was amazing. That was an amazing experience. And we did that whole thing, you know, during the pandemic. I directed the motion capture shoot remotely from the chair. Wow. And lightsabers, because that was a dogfight movie.
Right.
And then to do it again now with lightsabers was so cool.
This is it. This is it. I have finally reached it. Well, let's play a little bit. Let's play a little bit of the trailer, because I think we have it all ready to rock, and then we'll come back and we'll talk about it.
Sounds great.
Focus, Sahar.
Did you see?
Wow.
I know it is difficult to accept, but the Force has chosen you.
Now!
both children?
No. The brother shows little connection with the Force. Zahara, the Force has chosen you.
Zahara, no!
I sense your past, Padawan.
You can't take her!
Your pain, your fear. This is how the Sith and Jedi maintain control. Revealing the ways of the Force to some, and keeping it from others.
That was so good, man.
Thanks, buddy.
I was in it. I was in it. So you're telling me that took 9 months to do?
Yep.
Man. Good. Tell me, let's break it down. Like, tell me what step one is. Did you have to start with the environments? Did you just start with, like, characters and animation parts of it? How did you kind of tackle this?
So it started with BioWare, who makes the game, has been making it for the last 10 years. It's an MMO. They had a particular challenge, right? They said, hey, we have this new expansion coming out called Legacy of the Sith, and we know that we need Darth Malgus, this recurring character, to enter this place, get these plans in this holocron. Jedi try to stop him, and he's got to escape. And that was it. And so from there, I hired a team of writers to work with me on it. Alex Backus and Tanner Boyajian, Sam Schechman, Michael Callahan, some people I've worked with Josh Callahan, people I'd worked with in other capacities. And together we wrote a script and we pitched it through BioWare, through EA, through Lucasfilm, and got it established. And through that came some new characters that are new to the lore, new to the game, we're really excited about. Like Sahar Kateen, this young Twi'lek that has a part of her Leku tentacle that's been cut off. And once we had that script, we took it to Lucasfilm and ILM, and they agreed to partner with us in bringing this to life. And then awesome. Began the kind of normal animation process, which starts with visual development, concept art of the characters,
storybooking and all that. I mean, all
storyboarding. Yep. So we storyboarded the whole thing, and we make a board-o-matic, which is taking those boards and then cutting them together into crude animation with temp. And that's how you figure out, okay, how long is it? Okay, it's a little too long. We need to cut some beats. Are the lines working? Are the intentions working? Do we feel like there's enough action, not enough action? Is the music tone that we're using, this temp music, for communicating what we want to communicate? Do we have to change directions? So you figure all that stuff out even before you're really into 3D at all. But that's happening in parallel. So usually you storyboard it and you're doing this board-o-matic or animatic. And while that's happening, the visual development from concept art to 3D models to textured models is happening in parallel. And then those two processes kind of meet. Now that you know what, how long the film is, and you've basically made it once with paper and pencil, you now get to start replacing those shots in a process we call previs that stands up the film for the first time in 3D. Really chunky models that figure out all the characters' relationships to each other. So your whole film then gets stood up in 3D that way in a previs layout phase.
And it's and then, any of that green screen, or is it just all kind of digital?
It's all 3D. It's all digital.
Wow.
And so once we'd gone through that process, then we knew where the fight scenes are going to go. And so called up my buddy, Darren Ross, who's a really amazing fight coordinator, stunt coordinator. I'd worked with him multiple times, and he'd worked on Star Wars as well, had a great relationship with ILM. And he brought on a team of stunt actors, and we did stunt viz. So that means that...
That must have been awesome. That just must have been awesome.
Darren's amazing. The stunt actors were incredible. They really brought the fire. Lots of amazing ideas that we never had.
And did you put like things on them, like motion, you know?
Usually motion capture. But on this particular one, for a variety of reasons, COVID, et cetera, budget, we didn't go that route. And so what we did is we shot it live action as a stunt viz. So that means that we basically just shot it like a live action movie, except we're on a stage and using pool noodles instead of lightsabers. And, you know, they're... I'm joking, right? Like they were stunt sabers, and there were harnesses and ropes and pulleys to give actors boosts so they could jump really far. It's actually looked incredibly impressive. And we shot it from multiple angles so that we could animate over it, almost rotoscope it, and recreate those scenes in 3D without putting on markers and actually capturing motion capture for those scenes. So then you had this bizarre movie that looks like really models, but you cut to live action actors in a room wearing pads whenever there's a fight. But now, and on top of that, now you're doing VO recording, you know, you're doing VO sessions with the actors, recording their performances, and they're wearing cameras called facewear that's recording their facial performances so we can graft those onto the models. And so you have this very, disjointed process that then all comes together one by one. All the models get replaced with high fidelity models one by one. All the rough animation gets replaced with refined animation. The facial animation has the actor's performances mapped onto it and then tweaked and modified. The actual voiceover replaces the temporary voiceover. The composer kicks off and the temp music gets replaced with real music. And then once all that is done, then the sounds come in and the lighting replaces it. So you really make the movie. You're saying, how do you stay excited over that long period of time? It's because you're making the movie five times.
Right.
You wrote a script. That's making the movie. You figure out things. You learn things. Then you do it as an animatic. Then you do it as a previs. And then you actually do it with all the final assets, you know, one by one by one by one, all the way to the finish line. And it definitely goes through an ugly duckling phase in the middle where you're like, that looks,
you're like, this is gonna be bad.
That looks bizarre.
How long did it take for you to render everything in that? I know it was about 6.5 minutes, but I'm sure it took a long time.
Yeah, it takes a long time. Yeah, it takes a long time to render the final frames. It takes a long time. I don't have a number for you. ILM would know a lot better. But yes, these are very, processor intensive.
And did you have to have, like have a color go thing?
At the very end, but they're small tweaks because it's not like shooting live action. As we're lighting it, we were essentially lighting for what we needed. So the color grade wasn't really a huge departure from what we were seeing in the final lighting.
And when you're seeing final pieces coming together, are you seeing like scenes coming together? And there, you know, a lot of people probably think it's like chronological order, but it's never chronological order. It's usually like the most involved animated scenes are almost last, and like just some of the kind of like smaller scenes are the ones that you start to see kind of coming through. Tell me what that was like when it was just kind of slowly kind of coming together.
Yeah, it's all achronological. It just depends on which sequences we have the assets for that are ready to go. And so we would review it in pieces. We would review it sometimes shot per shot. And you review any given day might be animation reviews on these shots, but it's lighting reviews on these shots. And because of how long it takes to render, sometimes the lighting takes would be rendered every third, every fourth frame just to save processing time. And so it would look kind of stuttery. So you couldn't really judge the animation, but you could judge the lighting.
Right.
Or another common problem would be that you'd be working on both at the same time. So they need to be working on the lighting, but you're giving animation feedback because you're trying to improve the performance or tweak the performance. And so the very, very, very latest animation is in the anim takes, but the lighting team's like, we can't wait for you. We just need to take whatever's available and work on that. So right. There's actually an older performance in the lighting take. Newest performance in the film looks like you have to watch like two, sometimes three different cuts, and then just imagine in your brain what would happen if you put them all together. So we call it putting on dev goggles. Like you have to be able to see through the process,
right,
and know if you're sailing the ship towards the intended destination or not without actually seeing it all together.
So I worked on this animated short, and you know, I'd never worked with an animation team, and I worked with them out of India, actually. Cool. And, you know, 3 weeks would go by, for example, or 4 weeks, and I'd say, we made all kinds of progress. We can't wait to show you. And then it'd be literally 3 seconds of animated footage.
Yeah.
And I was just, like, sitting there like, man, that is a test of patience beyond music that I have so much more respect for, because just the fact that everybody was working on this for 3 weeks and for it to go grading over like how long it took to get it to that, man, I have so much respect for what you do, because it is not easy. And those details, even just seeing the final, you know, the final product, man, it looks amazing. You're in the world. The story is awesome. It is pulling on the heartstrings in such a great way because you see the conflict. But most people don't understand what it took to get it to that level and that detail. And man, hats off to you. But what were some of the biggest obstacles that you went through during the process where it was like, oh my God, maybe this is going to take longer than we thought, or it's going to take more people, or it's going to take way more of restructuring? What were some of the biggest obstacles you faced?
Avoiding the comparisons in your head. You know, you've got these amazing films, you've got amazing, you know, Star Wars video games that have come before you, other amazing Star Wars short films, and you have to just stay focused on the work and know what you want. So kind of plugging out all the distractions that'll take away from the process, I think, is always a challenge. Every production has its, you know, has its obstacles, nothing really to write home about. But I think the right spirit is always to take those and figure out how to use those challenges to up your creativity, right? So you know, with budgets, you always have, well, we can afford like this much animation, right? Like we have to find a way to trim sometimes seconds, sometimes frames. And so then how do you maintain the pacing that you want and still lose time, lose those you can shave and it'll actually improve it. And you didn't even think it would, versus knowing where you're going to really, really fight for it because you know you need it. And so that's a part of just, that's just a part of the process on working on something really big like this. And just making sure that you're taking everyone along for the journey, you know, and Charles Boyd, the creative director on the game, who trusted us with his baby, making sure that we are a natural extension of what he has done for all these years. His whole team has done that. The characters are moving like they should, speaking like they should, you know, have the right intentions, making Lucasfilm feel like, you know, we're cognizant of what they're doing with the brand. Right. And that, you know, they're helping us air traffic control around, so we don't accidentally get that feedback when they give it to us, being good partners with them, building it with them. That's also always a challenge when you're working on a big IP like Star Wars. Is you have a lot of layers of ownership and stakeholders, and it's not just about like your vision as a, you know, as a creator. It's you have to be able to bring all those people along the journey with you, and
you're trying to create like your own chapter. You know, it's like it is this huge world and universe, and you're trying to, you know, just stake your claim into making something that is original, pulls on a lot of the same themes, because that's what resonates with all of us. I mean, even watching that, it's like, oh man, you can tell the inner struggle and the conflict that anybody would have watching that. When you were writing the screenplay, how many pages was it in its final form, and how many did you have to do?
But as they say, the final rewrite is in post-production, right? That's the final rewrite. And so the script really isn't gospel. You move on from that, and then you're dealing with what you actually have in front of you. And we changed lines, trimmed lines, combined scenes. That was one of the really fun things that we found in the edit, was that there'd been two different scenes, and then we ended up intercutting them. And it really upped the tension even more. So in the middle of the film, when Master Orr and Sahar are talking, and she's confronting him about, you know, did you know about my brother? You know, was that chosen by the Force, or was that chosen by you? That used to be her own conversation. And then after this whole tug of war that they have, this, you had Malgus wake up in the rubble and start taunting them. And I realized that we could just intercut them. And so you have, you know, the Jedi saying, don't do it, don't do it, don't do it. And you have the Sith saying, do it, do it, do it. And that was way better. And it made it shorter. And so that's how, when someone kind of puts your feet to the flame and says, you know, creatively, you got to figure out a way to make it work with less, you find solutions that can really elevate what you had, make it better than you had before.
You know, this brings me to my next question. This is, I think, the plight of every artist. It's, you know, you have a vision, like what you said, you're like, I know I can do this in a certain way and execute. And then you have, there is a hierarchy. There are people that you have to kind of like, you know, cater to on some level. Like you said, there is a Disney branch, there's a Star Wars branch, there's the Lucasfilm branch. How do you kind of stay kind of, you know, to the course of what your vision is, and also kind of bend to whatever crazy whims that people want to change for the edit or the rewrites or a character, even a detail that maybe you may not see eye to eye on? How did you kind of cater to make those things happen?
You just have to show up with respect for everyone else that's there. You have to understand that this isn't yours. You know, someone else is letting you play with their toys. You know, I don't own Star Wars.
Right.
I have ideas, and you have to know what battles to pick, and you can passionately defend those ideas. But it's really about respect. you know, the game team has reasons for their feedback. Lucasfilm has reasons for their feedback, and the people that are actually, you know, working on the shots on a technical level day to day, if they tell you this isn't working, this is going to look weird, you know, they've been down this road before, and they're trying to save you struggles, you know, down the road. That's all things that you need to have an open and listening ear for. And so I think that a huge part of this job is soft skills, honestly. You need to have skills as a storyteller, but you have to have skills to motivate and lead a team and make everyone feel like they're along for the journey. And that's just as important. And I'm still learning that every single day. And I think that's what really separates people that are talented, people with them.
Right.
Because they value the people and they value the relationships. And it's not just about the work, or you definitely can't have this kind of, it's all about getting the right shot. You know, it's really not. It's about figuring out. It's really about figuring out how to give the team what they need. Sometimes you might get a note, and it's not going to actually give the team what they need ultimately. So now it's my job to really convince them, right? And that could happen from anywhere. And sometimes I'm the one who is kind of stuck on a detail that doesn't matter, and other people need to convince me. You just talk it through, and you have to get to the note behind the note. So, you know, there's an old saying that if someone's something with your almost right, it's wrong. And what that means is that when someone gives you criticism, you have to stop and take stock of it. Something's not working. Something about what you're intending isn't working, and it's creating this reaction. They might prescribe a solution. It's up to you now to decide, is that the right solution?
Right.
Or am I going to get to the note behind the note, but I'm going to get there a different way that won't break like 10 other things. And then you have to show up with those solutions. So that's the process.
Man, this is enlightening on so many levels, man. Thank you. What's next for you, Neil? Where can people find you if they want to see what's next on your amazing resume and portfolio?
No, thanks so much, Nikhil, for this chat. I really enjoyed it too. I'm really on LinkedIn these days. I don't get on social unless I absolutely have to. Gotcha for it. You can find me there. And yeah, go play the game. You know, I gave you the link where people can go and make an account and jump in, play Legacy of the Sith right now. And what's next is, you know, I just got the wind in my sails, and I'm just looking to continue creating, telling stories. And there's some fun stuff coming down the pipe at EA and things that I'm working on, just personal projects as well. And there'll be more to talk about when the time is right.
Well, Neil, it's been a pleasure to interview you. You're an inspiring creator. We got to collaborate on something because we're friends in the arts, man.
Yeah, man.
You're just a fascinating cat, and I wish you nothing but the best. And I look forward to seeing what else comes down the chute, man. Let's make it happen. So for me, Stump Pump, see you guys next week, and may the force be with you. Peace and love, everybody. Take care. Thanks. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Korula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.